Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. I appreciate you listening today. We told you on yesterday's show how Seattle's wealthiest, also whitest, elementary school PTAs raise millions to pay for extra teachers and staff at their schools, more than $4.5 million last year.
Because more and more we're competing with private schools, and if we don't offer a lot of the things that private schools offer, then we lose student and potential monies.
That's apparent at Seattle's McGillivray Elementary. McGillivray's PTA raised $422,000 last year, something parents are understandably very happy about. But is it fair?
We had very low-income people in our school, so we don't raise as much money as other schools. I know that there are some schools that raise $100,000, but we don't, unfortunately. So it's really kind of tricky and frustrating. But we had to find the ways to raise money, because if we don't, nobody else is going to do it.
That's the PTA vice president at Concord Elementary in South Park, where two-thirds of the students are Latino. Concord's PTA was going to hold a fundraiser this month, but they weren't even sure they'd raise enough money to cover their event license and permit. KUOW reporter Ann Dornfeld brought us that story and started a conversation that could change how PTAs in Seattle do business. Hi, Ann.
Hello.
We want to open this one up to you as well, listeners. Are you involved in your school's PTA? What do you think of sharing the PTA wealth among Seattle's richer and poorer schools? We're taking your phone calls at 206-543-5869. 206-543-5869. Ann Dornfeld, you spoke with the people behind the PTSA Equity Project. How would this idea work?
Well, that is up in the air. They want to hear from the public, hear from other parents, teachers, community members. They're starting a conversation in the new year, community meetings across town and different libraries to hear what people think would be fair if they think this is a terrible idea to begin with. They're not proposing one specific scheme for redistributing PTA wealth, but they'd like to hear what might work in Seattle and taking lessons from places like Portland that are already doing this.
How did it basically work in Portland that may or may not come here?
Yeah, in Portland, they've been doing it for decades. And what they do is PTAs can raise as much money as they want. But then if they want to buy teachers with that money, it needs to go into a foundation. And then from that foundation, after the first $10,000, a third of the money goes to an equity pool that is redistributed to low-income schools.
Okay, so this is just about teacher salaries. This is not about a district saying, we want to bring in new band instruments and a field trip to here and a new foreign language instructor. Well, foreign language instructor maybe would fit.
Sure, maybe not foreign language textbooks. Right.
Yeah.
So this is looking at staffing specifically, and staffing is in schools and with PTAs most of the money.
Okay. So what if Portland is doing it? Why not Seattle? What are some of the objections to this idea?
Some of the objections, I mean, in Portland, it was a unique case because the district was not allowing PTAs to pay for teachers, as happens in some other districts around here, like Bellevue and like Washington School District. But they had this big tax crisis, financial crisis, and they cut a deal and said, okay, how about this? We will let you raise money and it can go to teachers, but here is the caveat that some of it needs to be going to low-income schools. So, you know, that was a more agreeable way of getting things done in Portland. Here, we already have the right for PTA dollars to go to teachers. The district frowns upon it, but it is possible, and obviously it is happening. So I think that if you're saying what you're already doing, we're going to take some of that and kind of tax it, that is, in many cases, going to be an unpopular proposition.
Yes. What is the response to that? If some parents are saying, hey, that's not fair, that's a taking, what's the response to that?
Well, some parents say, well, you know, we already, as a PTA, are contributing to a school down the road that is a low-income school. We're helping with their fundraisers, or we're lending some volunteer hours, and we want that to be voluntary. We like that we have the ability to choose every year what we do for that school or choose our school. Others say this should be a focus on full, ample state funding by the legislature. They point to McCleary and they say, you know, this is a misdirection of our energies. We need to be looking at where the big dollars are. And that would, in many, to a lot of people's mind, come in with a state income tax.
A state income tax, which is not likely anytime soon.
Right. And so the folks from the PTSA Equity Project say, okay, McCleary's not going to get funded tomorrow. And also, even if it does, a lot of people say it's not going to provide the same kind of funding that we can, you know, fantasize about at every single school, the kind of funding that takes place at schools in Queen Anne or Ballard.
Let's hear more about this. We're talking about sharing the PTA wealth, one idea to make public schools more equitable in Seattle, and we want to hear from you. Ann Dornfeld just told you they're taking public comment, they're having community meetings in libraries, and that's what we're doing right now on KUOW. I'd like to hear from you, especially if you're involved in your PTA. What do you think of this idea? 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW. You can write us if that's better for you. You can email us, record@kuow.org. Now, as we said, we don't have to go far to find an example of this. Our neighbor is doing it. Rob Manning covers education at Oregon Public Broadcasting, and he's joining us now from Portland, where they've been sharing PTA revenue since 2015. Rob, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, thanks, Bill.
Why did Portland decide to share PTA revenue? What brought on the change?
Well, as Ann mentioned, there was a ballot measure, basically, or a series of ballot measures in the early 90s that Oregon voters approved that diminished the ability of schools to spend money out of property tax revenue. And so one of the pieces that came in response to that was the allowance of public or of private fundraising to dollars to go towards teacher salaries, basically. And the mechanism for doing that was creating these foundations. And the foundation in Portland was created such that 30% of the money raised at a local school foundation above the first $10,000 gets shared centrally, and then it gets distributed out in grants.
And how has that worked out?
Well, it is a little bit more equitable than what I think Seattle is experiencing. But as Ann mentioned in the story that she did, you know, these grants are typically only $20,000 or $25,000 for a local school, and that is not nearly enough to hire a full-time teacher. Rather, you know, it's money that they can use to, you know, again, buy supplies. They can maybe get a part-time person. They can get, you know, some other, you know, something fairly small. And then you still have, you know, the downtown wealthy high schools on Portland's west side and some on Portland's east side raising, you know, upwards of $100,000. So it's still not, you know, perfectly equitable.
KUOW's Ann Dornfeld, what did the Seattle PTSA equity people you talked with here, what did they say they learned from Portland?
Yeah, they said that they acknowledge the limitations of Portland's model. Folks I spoke to in Portland, and maybe Rob has heard this too, say, you know, perhaps a possibility would be to give larger grants to fewer schools. But even so, when you're talking about one third of the dollars, you're still going to be looking at inequitable distribution, right? But they said that one of the things that you do see from Portland's model, and of course, the inception of the model is different, so our mileage may vary here, is that it doesn't really cut down dramatically on how much schools are able to fundraise, or how much PTAs are able to fundraise, or other fundraising organizations. It's not sending parents fleeing for private schools because every single one of their dollars are not landing at their child's school. And that is a concern that a lot of people have voiced here, that this is just going to have a chilling effect on fundraising.
Was there any chilling effect on fundraising in Portland, Rob?
Well, it doesn't appear to have had that effect, no. I mean, there's still, as I said, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars getting raised at certain schools. And certainly there's always that fear that if you ratcheted up the amount that gets tithed off into the central foundation, that maybe that would happen. And that's why, you know, the percentage has remained at 30%. You know, there are other school districts like Lake Oswego in the suburban, you know, a suburban district near Portland, where they actually share every dollar. But that's a smaller school district. It's fairly uniformly wealthy. So there's less, I think, you know, concern about, you know, where is that money going. With Portland, you know, they've stuck at 30%. And I think that is sort of like they see that as a compromise, that like that's enough that people are willing to share that. If you go too high, maybe there would be that chilling effect.
We're taking your call if you have a question about how this might work in Seattle, and we're talking about Portland's experience, too. We're at 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW. We got an email at record@KUOW.org. Anne writes, what about making it like equitable tipping? While a larger percent of the donations would go directly to their home school, a smaller percentage would be distributed to lower-income PTSAs. So Anne wants us to think of it like pooling tips. And Rob, is that close to the Portland model?
That sounds similar. I mean, it is kind of like a lot of it goes to your home school, and then a chunk of it goes off into this central body. It could be that there are other mechanisms for redistributing that money, but I think that Portland has found that it's fairly efficient. There's not a high administrative cost to, you know, collecting and distributing out the money. I mean, it's a similar idea. I think it's a different way of describing it.
One of the things that I heard about Portland's model is that there are not administrative costs taken out of that fundraising. So that was a concern that I've heard from people in Seattle. They don't want to cut going to overhead, and it sounds like that's not happening in Portland.
Okay.
That's correct. There's basically they use other funds to cover their administrative costs at the Central Foundation.
Okay, I want to talk more about the odds of this actually happening in Seattle in some way. Rob, any final thoughts on this share the wealth idea that is being implemented, has been for a while in Portland?
Well, I think one other concern that parents have had is, does all this public fund or private fundraising for public schools have any effect on dulling the advocacy that they feel like needs to happen, where, you know, Oregon notoriously underfunds its schools across the state? And are people looking too much at their own local school and how much money they can locally fundraise and not doing as much as they could be doing to, you know, to basically increase tax revenue so that the whole state would benefit? And I think the PTAs and the school foundation people would say that that doesn't happen, but that's another concern people have.
Yeah, Rob, this is something that I've heard a lot, discussed a lot in Seattle, too, that if all the parent dollars and especially hours went in not to PTA fundraising, but to advocating at the legislature for ample funding of K-12 education, that we might have a different outcome in the legislative process. But it's interesting. I spoke to Vivian Van Gelder, who is one of the organizers of the PTSA Equity Project. She says, yeah, this is a drop in the bucket, actually. This is not anywhere near the kind of money we need to see from the legislature. But what this would do is shine a light on our incredible segregated school system in Seattle and an incredibly segregated city, and that even with ample funding of education, we're going to have these segregated schools, and where there is segregation in the school system, there is inequity.
Rob Manning is covering education at Oregon Public Broadcasting, and KUOW's Ann Dornfeld is here too. What do you think about this idea? And maybe you don't want to tell us on the radio. That's okay. You can write to us, record@kuow.org. Rob, hang with us if you would. Ann Dornfeld, what are the odds this will happen in some form in Seattle?
You know, I am a gambling woman, but I will say that
you were about to say I'm not a gambling woman, and I appreciate your amending that for the record.
There are others who know differently.
Right.
I think that I see it as likely, personally. I mean, perhaps not today or tomorrow, but I think that there are winds of change around us today, and I think that there is a lot of interest from a lot of people and folks who say that they would be giving even more to their child's school were this to be implemented.
That's an interesting idea. There is a fundraising tenet that people will say yes if you only ask them. So are you saying there's a suggestion that, no, actually, people might be more interested in paying if they thought that there was equity involved? Is that the idea? Because classic economics would be, right, I get less benefit, I give less.
Right. And that's what I've heard from folks. I mean, we're all, many of us, I'd say, are giving charitably anyway. So what's a few dollars more for a needy school?
Rob, any experience with that in Portland?
Well, I think that the school foundation people would say that that does, in fact, happen, that there are people who are charitably minded, who feel a little bit more comfortable knowing that, okay, this is not just me being selfish for my own kids, but there's a share of my donation that's going to go to needy schools elsewhere in the city. So I think there is a dimension to that.
Okay, winds of change in Seattle. I'm not sure what you mean by that. And just winds of change on this one topic, or are you saying that there's some kind of shift in Seattle schools that you've noticed? You've been reporting on local education for a long time.
I think all of the increased attention to issues of race and equity has really kind of, you know, lit a spark to mixed metaphors in a lot of people and made them wonder what they can personally do to kind of be the change they'd like to see in the city and in the school system. So I think that this gives a lot of people a tangible way to make a difference or feel like they're doing that.
Mm-hmm. Rob Manning, education reporter at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Thanks for telling us your experience in Portland. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And Ann Dornfeld at KUOW, I recommend, if you haven't heard her story yet, go to our website, KUOW.org, and you meet a variety of people. I love your choice to go to one of these very successful fundraisers where people, you know, they're focused on the dollars, and then you kind of widen it out from there.
It was quite the scene, yeah. It was kind of like a little Beverly Hills in Seattle, so it was nice to see how the other, you know, 1% lived.
Well, did those 1% seem conscious about all these race and equity issues that you brought up?
Yeah, I think that, you know, some people say that even in a wealthy school, there are kids who have special needs. They have low-income kids. They have kids of color. They have kids who could really benefit from a lot of the funding that does not go to their school because it's a higher-income school. And some argue that some of these dollars are going to benefit those kids specifically, like reading specialists or math specialists. I think that there's consciousness, you know, at every income level.
KUOW's Ann Dornfeld on the story for you. You've been listening to The Record on KUOW. Ann, thanks a lot. Let's talk about this again as it develops or doesn't.
Sounds great.
We'll be back with The Record in just a moment. Coming up on KUOW, we're going to examine a stereotype that can help men evade charges of sexual harassment and assault, the myth of the male bumbler. We're so confused. That's coming up on The Record in about 15 minutes, so stick around. I'm Bill Radke. It's been 2.5 months now since Amazon told Seattle it wants to see other cities and create a second co-equal headquarters in another North American city. KUOW's new podcast, Primed, explores our relationship with its biggest employer, including our tendency to blame Amazon and its thousands of highly paid workers for some of our intractable problems, like traffic and homelessness. In the most recent episode, reporters Carolyn Adolph and Joshua McNichols ask whether we are treating Amazon as the fall guy, the convenient foil to blame our problems on instead of owning up to our own shortcomings.
Do you remember Fish Truck?
How could I forget Fish Truck?
That's so true. It was 2:30 on a Tuesday afternoon in Seattle. A truck overturns on old Highway 99 just south of downtown, and it is packed to the gills with fish.
Wasn't that like frozen cod or something?
Yes. $500,000 worth spilled all over the road. There's going to be a Sounders soccer match in 4 hours. Hey, should be fine. But no. Highway 99 locks up. People are rerouted into downtown, and then downtown locks up. Epic traffic jam.
I got from my house to Westin Hotel, 5 blocks about within 45 minutes of driving. I was like, I got to park the car.
That's Stefan Fry, the goalie of the Seattle Sounders. He ends up parking his car in the middle of the road and running to the game. It's nearly midnight by the time they actually clear the fish truck off the roadway. 9 hours of gridlock.
That was the cod incident. There also was a bee incident and a tanker truck incident. And in each of these cases, a single truck crash cripples the entire city. Thousands of commuters can't get home or to work. This is the story of how we got to this point, how Seattle grew well beyond its infrastructure, and what we did or didn't do before Amazon arrived and pushed us to where we are today. I'm Joshua McNichols.
I'm Carolyn Adolph. From KUOW in Seattle, this is Primed.
Traffic, street traffic, 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 traffic. Did they hear that?
And our rent has gone up 10% every single year for the last 4 years.
If you're leaning away from the future is going to win every time.
This episode is about the bad decisions we made starting in the 1970s and the slow, inefficient ways that we make decisions today. This is the backdrop when people complain about today's Seattle, even though sometimes we blame those things reflexively on our biggest employer, Amazon. So how did we screw up? And are there lessons for other cities who look at our booming local economy with envy? We'll dig into that after this break.
Radioactive Youth Media on KUOW. I spent the summer at KUOW with 7 other teens. So many of us chose to tell our family stories of staying connected across oceans.
Sitting in front of the screen is as if we are just sitting next to each other. Of course, you can't touch each other, right? But it's so close.
And how we still find joy.
To manage to have moments of happiness is the most rebellious act.
To hear stories from Radioactive, go to kuow.org/podcast.
When Seattle was planning for Amazon back in 2010 or so, city leaders thought there would be 18,000 workers at most in Amazon's neighborhood. But we got more than twice that many people. 45,000.
Yeah. What happened between Seattle and Amazon is kind of like if you were throwing a party. You had invited just a few people, but somehow word got out. And all of a sudden there are 45,000 people outside, and you don't have nearly enough chips. Our failure to plan properly for the giant house party that was Amazon screwed up our city in two ways: traffic and housing. So first, let's look at traffic. This is an area where we had lots of opportunities to make things better, but we didn't. And the things we did do didn't really work. There's this one street, Mercer Street.
We're standing on Aurora Avenue overlooking what is being termed the Mercer Mess. Traffic lines up from beyond Seattle Center and stretches eastbound until you're on to Interstate 5. The folks at the traffic department tell us there's a better way to wade through all this, but it's going to cost all of us who are taxpayers.
That tape is from 1977. Over the last four decades, we talked about the Mercer Mess and basically did nothing about it. Then in 2010, Amazon moves in, and all of a sudden we spent $170 million trying to make Mercer better. We ended up with like 9 lanes for cars. At rush hour, it's like fish truck every day.
What's the worst you've seen it? What's the worst like traffic experience you had out here?
On Mercer, I've probably been on this street for at least 45 minutes just trying to get on the freeway.
So 45 minutes to go how many blocks?
Probably 5 or 6.
Traffic here when I'm coming in is insane. I mean, I was stuck here on Mercer for about 20 minutes this morning. My mom was dropping me off and it took like 20 minutes just to take a left turn.
Seattle's solution to the Mercer mess was essentially tinkering with the lanes and the stoplights. It's all about the car. What we really needed there was a light rail system capable of dropping tens of thousands of people there every day from all over the region.
We actually had an opportunity to do that 50 years ago. And like many smaller cities with no idea of the growth that was coming down the pike, we didn't seize it. There was this plan in the 70s called Forward Thrust, but we decided not to be thrust forward. We decided cars and buses were working fine, so we voted it down. It wasn't until 1996, a quarter century later, that we finally began investing in light rail. So we're building it now, but it's going to be another quarter century before the entire system is fully operational.
We can't build our light rail system fast enough to get ahead of population growth.
And we are not alone in being short-sighted in failing to invest for future growth. Kristen Capps of CityLab says Austin, Texas still rejects initiatives to build light rail, and it is considered to be among the top contenders for Amazon's second headquarters, HQ2.
And Austin has notoriously bad traffic.
Kristen Capps says even cities that have committed to light rail have fallen behind.
I think the story for a lot of cities is maybe less about not building any rail and more about not building enough rail, not building the kind of expansions in a timely way that they could.
So maybe I'm being a jerk for asking this, but if this were Amazon's problem, would it be solved by now?
You mean, how would Amazon have solved this problem?
Yeah. I mean, for one thing, it probably would have thought long term, right? Because Bezos just loves to talk about the future.
You have to always be leaning into the future. If you're leaning away from the future is going to win every time. Never, ever, ever lean away from the future.
Back in 1994, Jeff Bezos posted a job listing to a Usenet group, offering positions in a well-capitalized Seattle startup. The last line of the job listing said, "It's easier to invent the future than predict it."
What the heck does that mean, to invent your own future?
Should airplanes have wings? Should cars have square wheels or round wheels?
That's Amazon's Prime Minister of Ideas, H.B. Siegel. This wacky-sounding position actually tells you a lot about how they, as a tech company, think. How they're constantly questioning their assumptions using these wild thought exercises. Square wheels might seem pointless at first, but maybe not.
You might also have a wheel that changes its shape over, it goes over interesting terrain. Or you might have a wheel that is able to park on a hill.
Thinking about ridiculous questions sometimes leads to new ideas. So how does that apply to Seattle and its many problems? Orion Boudinot used to work in Amazon. He doesn't work there anymore. He's a virtual reality producer now. And he was more of a soldier than a general there. But like everybody there, he was steeped in the company culture. And that means absorbing the little fortune cookie expressions that Jeff Bezos thinks up. Boudinot reached out to us via our Facebook page, and he told us what he thought inventing your own future would mean for Seattle.
What are the crazy ideas that would fix the homelessness crisis in Seattle? What are the crazy ideas that would fix congestion? I mean, the idea has to be bonkers on some level, I think, in order to really be worth pursuing. You know, the people who think, well, Amazon will never succeed because the world doesn't work that way, don't understand that Amazon is in the business of changing the way that the world works.
Amazon invents its own future by not being stuck on the way things work right now. So if Seattle's problem is we're stuck in mind-numbing traffic, how would Amazon have approached that? Maybe they would have thrown out their assumptions. Maybe they would have said, well, do we have to add more people to this transportation network? What if we just added people to some other transportation network?
Well, actually, when you think about it, that's exactly what they're doing with HQ2.
Mind blown.
Incredible.
Okay, so Seattle operates with bad, outdated assumptions. What else do we do wrong?
Well, we're not a very decisive lot in the Pacific Northwest. More about that when we come back.
I'm Tan Tan, host of Second Wave, a new podcast from KUOW. My parents escaped Vietnam in 1978. They're boat people. And I've always wondered what that was like.
We're definitely in Vietnam. We're just going. We're just going with it. It's not like there's any life jackets.
On the next episode, I'm going back to where it all started, Vietnam. Go to kuow.org/podcast to learn more.
Okay, listen to this.
This is early in the process. We're hoping to have some formal recommendations come to council in May. And then we'll have deliberations starting in June in council on how we want to move forward on this. So it's great that so many folks are here today at the front end of what's going to be a long process.
Ah, that quote just drains the life out of you.
Absolutely. And that is the sound of the Seattle process. It is a real thing. The Seattle process even has its own Wikipedia entry. Definition: seeking consensus through exhaustion. That tape is actually about building more affordable housing. We really, really value consultation and input, and we do not place a premium on decisive action, even in a crisis.
And we are definitely in a crisis.
Housing costs are rising faster here than anywhere else in the country. Rents in Seattle are growing 8 times faster than the national average. That's according to Zillow. And last year, the average price of a home in Seattle went up by 13%. It stands now at around $750,000.
You know, you do what you can, but the rents just keep going up and up and up and up and up, and eventually you're out on the street.
And our rent has gone up 10% every single year for the last 4 years, which is an incredible amount for people on fixed incomes.
That is the sound of a crisis.
So, Seattle's political system is responding to this fast-moving crisis with our traditional, glacial, inefficient system of seeking consensus among stakeholders. We are moving way too slow. So let's ask this again. how might Amazon have approached our housing crisis? There's a hint in one of their principles as a company: disagree and commit. You fight over what's the best solution, and then there's a cutoff point. And whatever decision is made, everybody throws themselves behind making it work, so that when it fails, you can't say it was because of politics. It was because it was a bad idea, and now you have the data to prove it. So then you have to be willing to change your mind and pivot quickly to a new approach.
Anybody who doesn't change their mind a lot is dramatically underestimating the complexity of the world that we live in.
Just learn from your failures and move on.
Yeah, here's an example. Amazon had this auction site. It was designed to compete with eBay that turned out to be a complete boondoggle. Bezos loved it, but when it failed, he cut it off like a dying tree limb. Here's Ryan Budno.
In the government, if something fails, it's a big public issue, it's a PR nightmare, and it's likely that someone will get voted out of office. Whereas with Amazon, if something fails, they're just very sober-minded about why it failed, and they figure out what went wrong, and they figure out what's valuable about it and what can be salvaged from that.
Okay, to recap, we have diagnosed some problems in our cultural and political DNA that left us unprepared for Amazon. We could have made some smarter long-term decisions starting in the 1970s, and we definitely could streamline the way we make decisions. And we need to recognize when we fail.
There's a word to describe how Seattle approaches its problems, and it isn't inefficiency. It isn't stagnation. It's called democracy. You know, sometimes we hear this idea coming from tech companies that the problems of government can somehow be fixed by the magic pixie dust of disruption and innovation. But that ignores that these systems were built over decades for a reason. Ron Sims was the King County executive when Amazon's growth started to explode.
A government is a series of laws, and you're restrained by those laws. You have no choice. So you just simply cannot do what the private sector does, which is they can move with agility that government is not allowed to. Our purpose is greater than any single company interest.
Sure, local governments were responding slowly. But maybe if you look at it another way, they were responding deliberately.
Right. I mean, we talk about the Seattle process as slowing things down, and it does. But on the other hand, it's there to protect people from danger and injustice. It's there to keep us from building cheap fire trap apartments that burn to the ground. It's there to keep us from tearing down the best parts of our city, like the Pike Place Market or the Space Needle.
Or our first Starbucks store.
Really?
Unfortunately, the fact that Seattle chose to move deliberately didn't keep Amazon from moving just as fast as it wanted to. So we made some boneheaded decisions over the last 40 years. And our political culture moves at a glacial pace. Well, we did this in the name of democracy. But Amazon's growth steamrolled us. And future HQ2 cities, make sure that you learn from that. Also, maybe we could all learn a few things from Amazon.
So they have an extremely long view of history and their place in it. And I think, you know, Jeff Bezos, who once spent millions of dollars building a clock in the desert that will tell time for 10,000 years, you know, he's not thinking in terms of the next election cycle.
I don't know how you get politicians to do that. I mean,
yeah.
How do you tell a politician you just need to think past the next election cycle?
Right. That's, well, there you go. That's a big, that's the challenge.
We have this nostalgia for how things were, and we have these forces that are changing things without a lot of consultation. Kristen Capps of CityLab thinks American cities are at something of a crossroads. He says we might have to choose between the city we love and a city that can accommodate everyone.
It just seems increasingly that you kind of can't have both. You can't keep cities the way that they used to be, and you can't do that while you also make it a place where people can afford to live.
That means longtime residents, newcomers, and the company that has honestly been a golden goose. So HQ2 cities, these are the kinds of choices you're going to have to make.
We've been looking at Amazon's relationship to Seattle as a city. Next time, we're going to switch gears. Seattle residents, like everyone else on the planet, have another relationship with Amazon, a consumer relationship, and many of them feel just a little bit conflicted about it.
Amazon guilt.
That's next time on Primed.
And I hope you will subscribe to the Primed podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It's KUOW's The Record, back in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The list keeps growing of powerful men who sexually exploit women. Today, CBS fired journalist Charlie Rose after several women said Rose made lewd phone calls, walked around them naked, groped their bodies. Rose says he's greatly embarrassed, but also says, quote, "I always felt that I was pursuing shared feelings, even though I now realize I was mistaken." He was mistaken. Which sounds just like a man. We're too simple-minded to understand women, right, Jerry Seinfeld?
I bet you women would like to know what men are really thinking. The truth, the honest truth of what men are really thinking. Because I could tell you. Would you like to know? All right, I'll tell you. Nothing.
Yeah, we're thinking nothing. We're guileless. We're clueless. Maybe a little blameless.
We like women. We want women. But that's pretty much as far as we thought. That's why we're honking car horns, yelling from construction sites. These are the best ideas we've had so far.
People laugh because these ideas are recognizable. You can call it the myth of the male bumbler. And actually, it's no joke. It's what my next guest calls it, the myth of the male bumbler. Lily Loofborough is a culture critic at The Week. Lily, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
Will you tell us more about the male bumbler myth?
Sure, yeah. So I think the male bumbler is one of the most muscular stereotypes we have. It's the sitcom dad. It's the guy from the commercials who can't work his lawnmower or his washing machine. And it's a weird story that we have about men in American culture that presumes that despite the fact that men occupy the vast majority of leadership roles and are entrusted with the most positions of power, they're also, and at the same time, lovably clueless and incompetent. So yeah. The bumbler has become this kind of convenient myth for a lot of very powerful men to hide behind when there's evidence of their wrongdoing.
How do men get away with that myth being persistent at the same time they, as you say, supposedly perpetuate the idea that they're more competent in the workplace?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just so pervasive in pop culture that it's become one of those cultural scripts that we kind of run in the background of our brains. And so, you know, one of the most egregious recent examples to me was... you know, the bumbler doesn't know things even when he's been directly informed of them. So Vice President Mike Pence is a great example because to this day he maintains that he had just no idea that former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn was lobbying for a foreign power, even though Flynn told him in January and Pence got a letter about it back in November. But Pence has been acting very surprised. Surely not, really? And it's a testament to the power of the bumbler myth that it asks us to believe that the vice president of the United States is just that incompetent.
And you're saying the male bumbler myth acts beyond gender in this case. But Lily, the stereotypes come from somewhere. Where is the grain of truth, if any, in this stereotype?
I think the grain of truth is that there are genuinely awkward people who don't know how to behave. Always around others, but I think there's a crucial distinction usually between people who are genuinely bumblers and don't know how to handle themselves, and that they do it with the powerful and the powerless alike. They do it with men and with women. There's not this strange calculated targeting of people who are powerless behind the scenes.
Well, Charlie Rose, who I mentioned, claimed that he misread these women's intentions. Is that also an underlying stereotype that women are hard to read?
Yes, I think so. So the bumbler guy, he's always amazed and surprised to discover that he had any power at all and that he was perceived as using it, right? The idea is that he would never be using it deliberately. So if something bad happened between a man and a woman, it must have been a misunderstanding. But, you know, Charlie Rose, who said, as you said, like he was pursuing shared feelings, that's his account, but he allegedly exposed himself to unsuspecting coworkers that he lured to his home or to his hotel, and he did this regularly. It was a known routine. Like one woman was mocked for falling for the, quote, shower trick. You know, this was a pattern. So, yes, it's possible that Charlie Rose really thought that every woman he left working while he went to shower wanted him to flash her. even though one of them broke down crying. But, you know, you have to remember that this is a guy whose professional reputation is as a careful, insightful interviewer. So either you're world-renowned for being a perceptive, intellectual reader of people, or you're totally new to how human faces work. You don't get to have it both ways.
Yes, you pointed out that Harvey Weinstein and Louis C.K. and Al Franken, these people didn't get successful by being bumblers.
That's right. They've shown themselves to be enormously competent social networkers who've built really successful careers, and you have to know something about people and be able to work them pretty well in order to climb the career ladder the way that all of these very successful, wealthy men have.
Well, Lily, you also quote a writer in your column, the Myth of the Male Bumbler. You quote a writer who says that women do frequently say one thing and mean another and display reactions that don't match their feelings. And this writer says that that's survival behavior. Will you explain that?
Yeah, that was a really interesting Twitter thread that gave me a lot to think about. So Holden Shearer is the author of that thread, and what he was saying is that one of the kind of lowbrow comedy routines that you see all the time in comedy clubs is the idea that men don't know what women want, and that it's because women are kind of inscrutable and their behavior is impossible to detect. And his argument is that that's true and it's not funny, that the reason that women do this, the reason that they smile when they're trapped in a bathroom with a man who is not letting them out, is that that's a survival behavior. You have to do a certain amount of social navigating to not offend your boss, to not be immediately fired, to not have your professional reputation destroyed, which is what has happened to so many of the women who've been targeted by these men.
Do both genders plead ignorance equally if they think that's going to save them? Is this just a male manifestation of a human response to evade and plead ignorance?
I mean, I think there are definitely female versions of it, like the dits.
The dits.
You know, but I think that the dits certainly doesn't have the same amount of cultural power,
right,
either structurally or in pop culture, that men do. And certainly has not been able to victimize nearly as many people as this narrative we have about men being both, you know, kind of the only gender entrusted to have really difficult, responsible positions and also simultaneously too incompetent to be held responsible for anything they do.
How effective is this defense, given that Charlie Rose and Harvey Weinstein and Bill O'Reilly and Roger Ailes and Anthony Weiner all lost their jobs, and Bill Cosby's disgraced, and Woody Allen makes movies, but he's not well-regarded particularly? So how effective is this defense today?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump is president.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what I would say is that they have been getting away with this strange performance of incompetence for a very, very long time, and this is a really strange moment because there is some accountability. What's interesting looking back is how all of these men actually, while pretending to be social incompetents, were running really sophisticated social campaigns to destroy their victims' reputations behind the scenes. So, like, you know, Harvey Weinstein hired ex-Mossad agents to spy on his victims and keep them quiet. He started whisper campaigns to end their careers. Roger Ailes videotaped women in compromising positions so he could destroy them if they went up against him. And Bill O'Reilly allegedly called one of his victims to try to make her give him dirt on another one who was going to go public. So, you know, they have a lot of PR strategies that they have been running in the background for a long time. And the most powerful one is trying to convince their audiences that you could be next. This could happen to anyone. Anyone could accidentally harass and then have their career destroyed.
So,
and that's the power of the bumbler myth, is that if these men succeed at convincing people that there was no plan here, that this was all just spontaneous and a misunderstanding, it actually really feeds paranoia, right?
Yeah.
And in the, yeah.
Well, Lily, what steps do you take personally? You've obviously thought about this a lot. What do you do to fight back against the strength of the male bumbler myth and maybe others?
One of the big lessons for me with the recent sort of months of really disturbing revelations has been to realize, you know, just how much I lack objectivity, how many powerful cultural scripts I have running in the back of my head without realizing that I'm running them and that they're guiding my thinking and governing my assumptions. And so, you know, I think I grew up with, you know, this idea that women are deceptive and sneaky and venomous and that men are kind of guileless and innocent and dopey. And I think that's deeply insulting to men and women alike, for one thing. But I think, you know, that there's kind of a controversial proposition lurking there, which is that men are capable of being every bit as sneaky and calculating and venomous as women are widely suspected to be. And if we can actually learn or unlearn, I guess, our blindness to these male manipulative behaviors, that will take us a long way towards coming to some kind of honest reckoning of what's happening right now, because this is confusing and upsetting and hard.
Lily Loofborough, culture critic at The Week, I really appreciate what you wrote, and thanks for coming on with us to talk about the myth of the male bumbler. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And man, I'm curious what you're doing differently, too. Tell us, record@kuow.org is our email address, record@kuow.org, or leave us a message, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. What if you looked at the world around you, didn't like what you saw, and you said to yourself, you know what? I want to start fresh. I want to live in a controlled, safe environment of my own, and I want to handpick the people I'm going to do it with. Well, back in the 90s, a group of people did something kind of like that. They built a giant, really sophisticated terrarium, a biosphere, and shut themselves inside it to do research, all in the name of trying to understand more fully how Earth's ecosystems work. Well, things didn't go as planned. Jonathan Hirsch has the story. It's the latest episode of KUOW's environment podcast, Terrestrial.
The biosphere sits in Oracle, Arizona, just outside of Tucson. Laser Vantillo is a mechanical engineer, and he was there for the construction in 1987.
It was a hustle and bustle of people creating a new world.
A new world its creators thought should contain a bit of the whole world, literally. Ocean, farmland, savanna, rainforest. But underneath this new planet, instead of dirt, there was a laboratory outfitted with sensors to measure everything up above. Nitrogen levels in the soil, oxygen levels in the atmosphere. The person who first came up with this idea was this guy named John Allen. He had a bunch of projects, starting back in the 60s. A theater troupe, collective farm, a ship that sailed all over the globe, and then the biosphere. Laser Vantillo was inspired by Allen's ideas and decided to join his team.
So, to me, it was adventure. I was really into exploration.
In 1991, the Biosphere Project had raised tens of millions of dollars, a joint venture between Allen's team and Texas billionaire Edward Bass. And in March of that year, eight crew members embarked on their first mission. 2 years sealed inside. Gay Allen was a part of that crew.
If we had known all about our biosphere, building Biosphere 2 would have been really easy. We didn't know, and we didn't know as we walked in the door how a biosphere works. We still don't really know.
There were lots of challenges: food, water, oxygen levels. But for Gay and Laser, the importance of their work was clear. At the end of the first 2 year mission, they still felt that the problems inside the biosphere could help fix the problems outside, on Earth. But then it came time for the second mission. Pascal Maslin was a crew member, and she says there was increasing pressure to show the biosphere was a success. Then, just 4 weeks into the mission, the crew received a video call. It was two consultants Bass had recently hired to audit the biosphere budget, Martin Bowen and another consultant, a guy named Steve Bannon.
We got called into mission control, and there was this V-shaped table with a camera on us and a big television screen. And so we were sitting there in front of Martin Bowen and Steve Bannon and everybody, saying that they had taken over the biosphere and the old management team had been removed and they were in control now.
Yeah, Steve Bannon, the same Steve Bannon who would later run Breitbart News and serve as an advisor to President Donald Trump. According to the project's backer, Ed Bass, the biospherians were chronically over budget, and the kinds of innovations that would make the biosphere a good investment, they weren't happening fast enough. So he brought on Bowen and Bannon. Everyone I spoke to for this story was hesitant to talk about Steve Bannon's involvement in the project. But Pascal did comment on where Bannon ended up years later, going from managing the biosphere to playing a critical role in the first year of the Trump presidency.
He's a master of hostile takeovers, isn't he? And, you know, at least at the beginning of this administration, it looked like he was orchestrating it.
Bannon is, of course, no longer a part of the Trump administration, And shortly after leaving, he told Bloomberg News that he was, quote, going to war for Trump against his opponents on Capitol Hill, in the media, and in corporate America, end quote. And again, just to be clear, Bannon was brought on as the interim CEO of the Biosphere by Ed Bass. As for the Biosphere, after several more months, the second mission was terminated. Eventually, the facility was sold to Columbia University, who later sold it to the University of Arizona. It's since been open to the public. However, no researchers live inside.
Jonathan Hirsch is a producer on KUOW's Terrestrial podcast. To hear the full episode, head to kuow.org/podcast. And that's it for today. Our show's put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Gemma Brempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel, and I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening today.